theguardian.co.uk.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Walking south across the Thames on the Hungerford footbridge recently might have noticed a small boat marooned on the top of the South Bank Centre. It's the Room for London, and it'll be there for the whole of the Olympic year. For 4 days in every month, it'll be occupied by a writer as part of an Art Angel project for the Cultural Olympiad. Musicians will also be playing a series of concerts which will be live streamed on the Guardian website over the year. The first is by violinist Andrew Bird. I went to meet the first of the writers, the Colombian novelist Juan Gabriel Vázquez, as he emerged from his 4 days in solitary confinement in one of the most desirable locations in London, clutching the essay he'd been commissioned to write during his stay. I've just come up a very rickety lift that's stuck in a gap between two bits of the South Bank, the Royal Festival Hall and the Queen Elizabeth Hall. It takes a very long time. You feel like you're going to heaven, but actually you're not. You're coming up to this platform which is set on top of the South Bank, and it's got a scaffolding walkway, and the boat itself is an amazing sight with a wind turbine on top of it, and the front of it juts right out over the Thames. And from where I'm standing now, I can see Blackfriars Bridge, buses going along Blackfriars Bridge to the right, and the Dome of St Paul's and the Barbican, and then to the left the Millennium Wheel and the whole of the North Bank of the Thames lit up. It is absolutely spectacular view. I can absolutely imagine that it would be a very fertile place to write. And on the back of the boat I can just see in the steel hull the words Roi des Belges, which of course is the name of the boat in the Heart of Darkness, and this is modelled on the Heart of Darkness. So let's now go and knock at the door and find Juan, who is just finishing his 4 day stay here. And the man has just opened the door to the boat, and it's Juan Gabriel Vázquez, who is the first of the Room for London occupants, who is just exiting after his 4 days in solitary confinement. How's it been for you?
Welcome to the boat. Welcome to my boat. It has been great, actually. 4 days of complete concentration, almost complete solitude in this great place. Well, I have been writing a little essay. I have been rereading a lot of Conrad, which was the original idea, and particularly three novels, Heart of Darkness, obviously, because the boat has a lot to do with Heart of Darkness, Nostromo and The Secret Agent, and I have been writing a little bit about those three novels.
So you are tasked in return for 4 days board and lodging in what must be one of the premier addresses in the whole of Europe at the moment. You are tasked with writing a short piece which will follow this interview.
I decided to discuss the way in which Conrad has been prophetic. The boat is the Roi des Belges, which is obviously the boat in which Conrad did his famous trip to Congo, up the Congo River, I mean, in 1890, subsequently wrote Heart of Darkness, based on that trip. In the novels he published after 1899, Nostromo, Lord Jim, The Secret Agent, and Under Western Eyes, anticipate every major conflict we would have in the 20th century. Colonialism, nationalisms, terrorism in The Secret Agent. I thought it was the perfect environment to rethink those issues and to discuss them in writing, which is maybe the only way I can think about things.
You've referenced Conrad in your two novels, and the best known of which is probably The Informers.
The Informers and the Secret History of Costaguano, which is my other novel, published in English, are very different books. The Secret History of Costaguana comes from a historical speculation, the idea that Conrad might have been to the Colombian coast in 1876, when he was just 19 years old, smuggling guns for the conservative government. We have absolutely no proof of that, but we do have some proof that his novel, Nostromo, was based, at least in part, in the political situation in Colombia at the time, which is that this Colombian province called Panama was seceding from the rest of Colombia with the military aid of the United States to protect a kind of particular asset they had, which was being the territory where a canal could be built. That reflects almost word by word Conrad's novel. So Conrad was actually writing about my country. And that became the subject of a reflection on history in my novel, on history, on the relationship between history and fiction, on how things change when you tell them, on who has the right to tell some things. Whereas in The Informers, Conrad is just one of my personal gods, one of my strongest influences.
Is he widely regarded in your country, Colombia?
I don't think so. I don't think many people knew the relationship between Conrad and Colombia. Conrad has never been much of a literary influence for Colombian novelists, except maybe for Álvaro Mutis, who is perhaps the other great Colombian novelist of the generation of García Márquez.
Can you just set the scene a little bit of this amazing space that we're in, which is shaped like a boat with lovely wood panelling, grained with wood in a way that actually rather reflects the graining on the concrete, weirdly, of Dennis Lasdon's South Bank Centre. Describe what it's been like to be here for 4 days.
We're going through the first door into a space that in which there's a kitchen and an octagonal table. Now, this octagonal table has its story. David Kahn, the architect who designed all this, told me that it's here because it's taken directly from one of the scenes in Lord Jim, Conrad's novel, in which, now that I've checked it, I know that Marlowe, the narrator of the novel, and Jim actually sit around one such table, octagonal in shape. And the same thing happens with many other little details around the boat, which mirror Conrad's novels, which try to recall certain episodes. What else? We have some metallic stairs going up to the top floor or the deck of the
boat. A library. They call it a library, don't they? And it's full of books about Conrad or about London.
The whole place, if you see, even what is my room around the bed is full of books about Conrad and London.
Upstairs, and rivers.
And rivers, yes. And books by the authors who will be staying here. You can find books by Jeanette Winterson and Michael Ondaatje. The upstairs library is also the way out to the deck. And the view over there is just magnificent. I think it's one of the great privileges of being here. Although I must say, I prefer the view from the inside. The idea that I'm looking at the same time at I don't know, the bed I am sleeping in, a sort of couch, and the River Thames, and the nightlights in the city, is just great.
What inspired you when you were here?
Well, I've had changing weather, and this has been very interesting. And I must say, I never noticed how the river changes color. At some moments in the day, the river is brown, the same color as the leafless trees you have over here. But as the clouds change and the sky changes, the river changes color in a very interesting way. So this is something I have been following closely, almost obsessively.
So now let's hear your essay.
The Prophetic Decade of Joseph Conrad. Day 1. Arrival. Tide at 1947, 1 meter. I have come to the river, to this steamboat run ashore on the rooftops of London. 121 years and 172 days after Captain Joseph Theodore Conrad Korsunovsky, on board SS Roi de Belge, wrote these instructions. Lowland and outlying sandbanks a little to port, steering for a little square white patch,
Stick on it. Pass close to the sands, cautiously. But that was another river. We think of it, the old Congo River, as going into the heart of Africa, whereas the Thames goes out from London and into the world. There's a distance between the two rivers, and it is not geographical. One has to be cautious when measuring it. Cautiously, I measure the distance I have covered to get here. It is the distance between Bogota, the city of my birth, perched 8,000 feet over sea level in the middle of the Andes, and the city I see through these 14 windows, in which, according to Conrad, men and sea interpenetrate. It is also the distance between my country, former subject of an empire on which the sun allegedly never set, and this country I write from, former head of an empire, about which Conrad once made the same claims. Finally, it is the distance between my first reading of Heart of Darkness, when I had just turned 16, and the most recent one, the 9th or 10th, I have lost count, which I began a couple of hours ago, having just been shown to my quarters for the first time aboard my steamboat. My steamboat on the roof, from whose stern I dominate large stretches of this river and this city that are, in their very own way, inscrutable fictions. Our favorite novels are like buildings we know well. Who lives where do which stairs lead, how to reach the basement. Today, however, Heart of Darkness is not a building, but a steamboat in which I've been sailing all my writing life, and whose private geography, its pilot house, its cabin, its mess room, I know as well as the house I grew up in. In 1899, in three magazine installments between February and April, Conrad published this story that I now read as the calling card of a prophet of the 20th century. To my mind, its publication inaugurated a supernatural decade in which Captain Kosiniewski, in a novelist's guise, painstakingly explored every tension and tribulation of the years to come. Here, about to sail without sailing, I lay out the proofs of Conrad's vision on my octagonal desk. Three novels, as three crystal balls. It is night now. The shape of the desk, David Kahn told me, is taken directly from a scene in Conrad's law gym. I find it. Jim and Marlowe sit around an octagonal table talking about hell. And Conrad writes, "The night, glittering and somber, seemed to hang like a splendid drapery." My London drapery is fully lit. The National Theatre is red, the London Eye is white and blue, and Conrad writes, "The riding lights of ships wink afar like setting stars." And there are ships on the Thames, but they are quiet and dark and still. I climb to my steamboat's deck to look at the sky, but all I see is a cloud covering the illuminated city, a cloud whose darkness, as the darkness of the blind, is never perfect. Day 2. Heart of Darkness. Tide at 1:30, 6.7 meters. Jet-lagged, I wake up a little before 2 in the morning and read Marlowe's story under the creamy light of the small light bulbs set over my bed. After 3 hours of hallucinated reading, my eyes hurt and words have begun jumping off the page. I blame it on my imperfect vigil, my impaired attention, my excited sensibility. Marlowe has just talked about his battered, twisted, ruined tinpot steamboat. I get out of bed, I turn on every light of my own steamboat. It is not so twisted, it is hardly battered. And I start walking around with a novel in one hand and a photograph of the original Roi des Belges in the other. I lie down on the wooden floor. This is the part of the deck where Marlowe heard the name of Kurtz for the first time. I walk up the metallic stairs to the pilot house where Kurtz's life began, in Conrad's words, ebbing out of his heart into the sea of inexorable time. But I am unable to make up my mind about the cabin. Where would it be, The cabin, of course, is where Kurtz would pass judgment on his own past, and at the same time, on our impending future. The horror. The horror. In Conrad's manuscript, there was only one exclamation. Dread was singular. The redoubling of words in the definitive version is what has branded them in our reader's memory, what has earned for them a permanent space in our mythology. After hearing those words, after watching the hideous transformation of the dying man's ivory face in the half-light, Marlowe blows out the candle and leaves the cabin. In the mess room, he meets the rest of the crew. They are dining, and he joins them. It is then that a young boy appears in the doorway and announces, with words T.S. Eliot would later steal, "Mr. Kurtz, he dead." Everyone else runs to see the body. Marlowe stays, pretending to eat, but it is fear that pulls him back, an atavistic fear. "There was a lamp in there," he says. "Light, don't you know? And outside was so beastly, beastly dark." I have never read those lines without a slight shudder, an intimate, shared terror. Now, in my steamboat on the roof, I turn off the lights, all the lights, and in the depth of night, exhaustion fills my conscience with an unreal silence. And suddenly, there they are, the images of Conradian horror as interpreted, or should I say understood, by an American film, the Vietnam War, the burned bodies of children, Wagner's music as background for bombings, and that ox, clubbed to death with a machete, its grey back broken, the black blood staining the yellow ground. In Exterminate All the Brutes, Sven Lindqvist highlights the secret liaison between the European colonization of Africa and the Holocaust. Conrad's little book is a yardstick against which we can measure our experience, the experience of a century. Day 3. Nostromo. Tide at 1442, 7 meters. It is raining heavily on the river outside. Inside, Conrad talks to me about my country and my continent, their convulsive history. Our relationship changed with my reading Nostromo, Conrad's 1904 novel about the fictitious Latin American Republic of Costaguana. As all great novels, Nostromo allows for multiple interpretations, but for me, it is, and always will be, a roman à clé about the national traumas of Colombia. I read it for the first time during a long Belgian winter, wondering how was it possible that a Pole writing from England could make me feel the humid heat of the Caribbean coast. In the novel, the province of Sulaco secedes from the Republic of Costaguana with the military aid, or is it the intervention, of the United States? In history, the province of Panama secedes from the Republic of Colombia with the military aid, no, the intervention of the United States. The real-life events took place in November 1903, while Conrad was writing the novel. American interests in the Panama Canal played a crucial role in the revolution. Where history was yelling Panama Canal, Conrad whispered Silver Mine. And the barter, the wonderful barter of fiction, was accomplished. Sometime before Christmas that year, Conrad wrote to his friend Robert Cunningham Graham, "And apropos, what do you think of the Yankee conquistadores in Panama? Pretty, isn't it?" Our long and sad century saw the place name in that falsely casual sentence substituted many times. Nicaragua, Honduras, Haiti, Dominican Republic, Cuba, Guatemala, and Chile suffered, albeit in different ways, the consequences of the Monroe Doctrine. I turn to the novel and find the ominous words of a millionaire by the name of Holroyd. "Time itself has got to wait on the greatest country in the whole of God's universe. We shall be giving the word for everything: industry, trade, law, journalism, art, politics, and religion, from Cape Horn clear over to Smith Sound, and beyond too, if anything worth taking hold of turns up at the North Pole. And then we shall have the leisure to take in hand the outlying islands and continents of the earth. We shall run the world's business whether the world likes it or not. The world can't help it, and neither can we. Reading Nostromo, I run into Don José Avellanos, the man who is arguably the moral conscience of Costaguana. In the novel, he receives the treatment reality, or Latin American reality at least, usually affords to moral consciences, general contempt, and a premature death. Don José is modeled after a very real Colombian living in London in 1903, Santiago Pérez Triana, ambassador plenipotentiary, son of an exiled ex-president, and the author of books for children. And I can't help thinking that in these moments, on board my steamboat, watching the Thames turn white under the pale light, I am a Colombian interpreting London through Conrad, just as in 1903, Pérez Triana, a foreigner in London, helped Joseph Conrad interpret Colombia. Day 4. The Secret Agent. Tide at 9:53, 0.5 meters. This will be my last day on board. I climb up to the pilot house and go out to the deck. The river today is brown, the color of these leafless trees. The morning light is scant, and the smell of rain is in the air. When did Joseph Conrad see this view for the first time? What did he see when he saw it? I read The Secret Agent and cannot help but feel Conrad was a stranger to London, in much the same way as I am a stranger. Perhaps this is why I have always felt sympathy for the London of The Secret Agent, for its costly, artificial qualities, for its tourist guide insights. But great novels are more intelligent than their authors. They see more, they see better. At their best, the books we call classics are Pandora's boxes whose warnings tend to be vindicated by history. One of the most fearsome characters in The Secret Agent is Mr. Vladimir, theoretician of terrorism, who at some point in the novel suggests a series of ideal outrages. Let them be directed against buildings, for instance, he says, and that on two conditions. First, the said buildings must be a fetish recognized by all the bourgeoisie. And second, the terrorist attack must be an act of a destructive ferocity so absurd as to be incomprehensible, inexplicable, almost unthinkable, in fact, mad. I was not in London when the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center fell in September 2001. But later, when the beginning of the war in Iraq was broadcast live on television, I watched it from a friend's living room near the Emirates Stadium. Like many, I thought the war was a mistake. Like many, I regretted the atrocities of Abu Ghraib. Like many, I was wounded by the images of the red buses torn apart on the 7th of July. But like very few, I remembered the all too believable words another terrorist pronounces in Conrad's novel. To break up the superstition and worship of legality should be our aim. Nothing would please me more than to see Inspector Heat and his likes take to shooting us down in broad daylight with the approval of the public. Half our battle would be won then. The disintegration of the old morality would have set in its very temple. To what extent did they achieve this, those who attacked New York and London? I do not yet have the answer, but I will not stop asking the question. Once again, I ascend the metallic stairs to the pilot house, but this time I close the trapdoor behind me and climb the ladder through the hatchway and go out to the upper deck where the wind blows harder and the rain hurts my face, and I remember, looking at the city, that the 7th of July bombings took place the day after London was chosen to host the 2012 Olympics. And I say to myself, now the year has arrived. And I say to myself, it is good to be here.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.